Hello, my name is Christoph, and you're listening to History of Asia, where with each consecutive episode, we travel further back in time. But today, I want to interrupt our journey for a second and explain to you why I'm doing that. For this is not the proper way to go about it, is it? History is supposed to be narrated in chronological order. That's so obvious, no one even bothers pointing it out. We experience time this way. And narrating history chronologically is therefore the most natural thing in the world. Why on earth would anyone want to change that, right? Oh, and come to think of it, have historians not sternly warned never to read the present back into the past? Even if you do this inadvertently, you must brace yourself for all sorts of expensive-sounding accusations. Teleology, presentism, hindsight bias, what have you. And I'm doing this on purpose, so what the heck is wrong with me then? Well, I have reasons to believe that this approach has unique advantages, and it's long past time I explained them to you. If this were a book, I'd do that in the introduction, but most readers skip that part, and I figured, if the first episode of a podcast featured a long theoretical discussion, listeners would be put off by that. I wanted to avoid that half of you would run for the exit before I even got started. So here's a little warning note. This will not be for everyone. If you just want to get on with the story, that's of course fine by me. If you can easily skip this episode and jump right back in next time. For the rest of you, thanks for hearing me out. I'd like to start with a basic question that those of you who teach history will be all too familiar with. What's the point? What is the point at all of studying history? Pupils probably ask you that every year, no? And no doubt you will have your clichés ready. Those who do not learn from the mistakes of the past are doomed to repeat them. But is it really that simple? For starters, what is a mistake, historical or otherwise? It's all too easy to pass judgment when you already know how things will turn out. In fact, that is one of the main arguments against reading history backwards. But if you're one of those people that claim to draw lessons from history, you risk falling into this trap yourself. And yet somehow, that doesn't seem to be a taboo against learning from the mistakes of the past, is there? On the contrary, people get lambasted for not doing so all the time. Take the Iraq War. This is often cited as a textbook example of a historical mistake. Now, you can argue about that, but even if you accepted that it was a 100% mistake, what's the lesson then? That you can never impose democracy on another country? It's been done. In Japan, in Germany, with immediate and lasting results even. Or is the lesson that you cannot do this in a country with deep fault lines? Well, every country has fault lines. So did Japan. So did Germany. What counts as a deep fault line then? Or is the lesson that you can't do it in a country without a democratic tradition? Iraq did have experience with elections and all that. Doesn't that count as a democratic tradition? Or is it that you can't pull it off unless you spend enough money as an occupier? How much is enough? Spend it on what exactly and how? Perhaps it was all doomed from the start, or perhaps it might have been wonderful if it had been handled some other way. So identifying the mistakes of the past, let alone learning from them, it's easier said than done. Some would say that the lesson is that there are no easy lessons. If you claim that history teaches you how to react in a certain situation, then you have to assume that the crucial variables haven't changed. But the further you go back in time, the smaller the odds that this is actually the case. As Heraclitus said, you can't step into the same river twice. Many battles have been lost because the tactics had been adapted to the previous war. Some even go further. They look at history to find aspects of human behavior that never change. Look at history and you'll see human nature. If you see similarities between cultures that have never met, then it's tempting to draw conclusions from that about the essence of human nature, no doubt. However, we have to beware of the black swan fallacy. Just because you never find human culture without tribalism doesn't mean it can't exist, or even that it hasn't existed. It's far from obvious that humans even have an essence. After all, our species is evolving, isn't it? Just like anything else. Now, I'm not saying it can't be fulfilling to approach history as a self-help book or a philosophical guide. I do it all the time, not in the least in this podcast. I love it, it's fun. But should it be mandatory as a subject in school? If our only answer to the question, what is history for, is that it avoids repeating mistakes, well, then I'm not so sure whether that justifies its place in the curriculum. Shakespeare's Macbeth stated, "All our yesterdays have lighted fools. Life's but a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." And many would agree. I wouldn't go so far, though. History can serve other purposes. For me, the most important one is that it can show us how we got to where we are, how our world came into being, why things are what they are. In other words, it's a quest for causes. Now, whether history can provide that is debatable too. The most popular historian of our age is no doubt Noah Harari. In his celebrated bestseller Sapiens, he claims that, and I'm paraphrasing, the more you learn about a historical event or process, the more you come to understand that it's mostly the product of coincidence. And this would imply that if someone gives you a clear answer to the question why certain things came to pass, then that must mean this person only has superficial insight himself. Why did Christianity become dominant in the Roman Empire? Oh, coincidence. What explains the rise of fascism? Coincidence. Now, let me be quick to point out, I might be making an unfair caricature out of it now for the sake of the argument. I don't mean to second-guess Professor Harari. I presume he was just trying to get an important point across, namely that almost nothing about history was ever inevitable. That is an inspiring thought. Think about it. How often do we hear, there is no alternative? History can show that there are other ways of doing things. However, if there really is no answer to the question why things happened, if history only teaches that everything is contingent, then once you realize or accept that, why would you ever need to open another history book in your life, right? Then isn't it odd that Harari then goes on to write a book titled 21 Lessons for the 21st Century? Now, there is a fundamental reason why history fails to give clear causal explanations. It's essentially the same reason why it fails to offer definitive lessons. Its theories are often hard, if not impossible, to falsify. History is no laboratory that allows you to keep variables constant. There are no real control groups. You can't replicate a historical experiment like you can with a chemical one. Historical analysis is therefore, by definition, an imperfect, subjective, and ever unfinished project. It's more art than science. But that does not make it redundant. Some have even claimed that art can save the world. Not so sure about that, but it certainly is valuable to know, as best we can, how the current situation came about, for multiple reasons. Suppose, for instance, you are considering to change a law. You can take many things into consideration, like the estimated costs or the popularity, but it also makes sense to find out why this law was introduced in the first place. Were there good reasons for this? And are these still valid? If it turns out that it was all the result of horse trading or mere folly, in other words, of the hand of fortune, then that's important information too, isn't it? So the fact that coincidence often plays a part does not render historical analysis obsolete. On the contrary, it can also show pitfalls. Let's again take the US occupation of Iraq as an example. Its catastrophic results are often attributed to historical blindness, and I think there is some truth to this. It might not have expected the transition to go so smoothly, for instance, if it had paid closer attention to how Saddam had hollowed out Iraqi institutions. The US probably underestimated the conflict between Shiites and Sunnis, which dates back to the 7th century. According to Peter Galbraith, the president was hardly aware that this split was even a thing before he ordered the invasion. Might have been something to consider. Or take the fact that democracy was presented as a gift from a more advanced culture, apparently without realizing that the Iraqis saw their own lands as the cradle of civilization. Not to mention President Bush's outlandish statement that the war on terror was a crusade. Under such conditions, words do matter. Knowledge is power, Anyone who understands the other person's historical background stands to benefit from this. You have to know where the other person is coming from, as they say. Ideally, such knowledge leads to mutual understanding and better cooperation. Unfortunately, of course, like any kind of knowledge, it can also be used for evil purposes. Sun Tzu advised to know thine enemy. The Nazi slogan Arbeit macht frei made cynical use of the knowledge that Jewish communities had long survived by making themselves useful to outsiders. Ironically, however, the Holocaust itself was of course motivated by a totally unrealistic reading of history. This brings me to the main reason why history, and indeed this podcast, might also be useful to you, dear listener. Agreed, the chances are slim that you will have to reform Iraq someday, with all due respect, of course, but a society, and certainly a democracy, lives or dies by the education of its citizens. In our globalized world, we frequently come into contact with Asia, directly or indirectly. In our history books, Asians appear as adversaries, Persian despots, Attila the Hun, kamikaze pilots, and that colors the lens through which we view the world today. On top of that, Asian countries that regularly make the news usually appear as a threat. Fear and conflict sell newspapers, after all. Even journalists with the most noble intentions have little room to deliver context. The consumer of the news media is thus dropped in the midst of a complex story, and usually a bloody one, full of unknown characters. The histories of these characters largely explain their behavior, but if this background is unknown, the natural response is to look for surrogate explanations in stereotypes. It's all too easy for us non-Asians to legitimize our own misunderstandings by assuming that the Asian is just fundamentally alien. It even sounds modest, doesn't it? Oh, I don't pretend that I can understand what goes on inside the head of an Afghan. Well, of course, there are limits to our empathy, but that's not limited to other cultures. Asians are not Martians. To the extent that they differ from us, that's largely due to the fact that they have a different history. Provided we educate ourselves, their culture and views become less incomprehensible, as I hope that this podcast will illustrate. Historical insight can offer a unique antidote to populism. If an outsider looks at what goes on in some part of the world of which he has no background knowledge, what he sees will often make no sense to him. If he would then simply recognize that this is because he lacks context, there would perhaps not be a problem. But we are rarely so humble. What usually happens is that people reason, if this makes no sense to me, that must mean it makes no sense at all, period. Giving up on understanding other cultures is therefore not innocent. It's only a small step from incomprehensible to irrational. That is dangerous enough in itself, but worse, it leaves us open to manipulation. Some politicians build their entire careers on exploiting fault lines, us versus them. This requires that the audience does not recognize the other's actions or viewpoints as valid, reasonable, human. And this is so much easier if you don't know anything about the other person's past. More often than not, there are perfectly understandable reasons why people do what they do or think what they think. For instance, in my own country, Belgium, there is more unemployment in the south than in the north. Now, given the economic history of both regions, this is not so illogical. Why would it be then that some politicians manage to attribute this to the supposed laziness of the Walloons? Why on earth would that be the case? Does speaking French magically make you less frugal? The reason, at least I think, is that we often don't want to educate ourselves, or we don't have the time for that. But we don't want to admit our ignorance either. If we can't come up with a sensible explanation, we resort to the stereotypes that are readily available. And for well-meaning people, it's hard to argue against this if they have to admit that they don't understand it either. Or take anti-Semitism. According to some persistent theories, the Jews control big business, and by extension, the media and politics. Like any effective form of fake news, this contains a tiny element of truth. Jew haters, for example, can refer to the Rothschild Bank, and they do so ad nauseum. Or they can point to the fact that Israel receives an enormous amount of aid from the USA. Every time a conspiracy theory is repeated, it reinforces itself. After all, we are inclined to assume that there is no smoke without fire. Such pernicious fables can only be dispelled by offering reasonable historical explanations, both for the prejudice itself and for the phenomenon that it purportedly explains. Now, what I mean by reasonable is not only that it may not be proven wrong, after all, you cannot falsify that the Smurfs exist. For an explanation to be valid, you need historical facts that support it. For example, it's a fact that Jews in Europe have for centuries been excluded from most professions. They couldn't own land, they were not welcome in the guilds or the army, and of course they couldn't join the church. So what could they do? Well, a notable exception was finance. If you know that, you'd no longer be surprised if Jews today were strongly represented in banking. Have you thereby proven a direct causal link between past and present? Not when measured against the yardstick of the natural sciences, I suppose. But at the very least, this explanation makes logical sense, which cannot be said about the crackpot theories about worldwide evil conspiracies. If more people were aware of Jewish history, anti-Semitism would not be so rampant, I think. And this is far from the only example. Therefore, it's not an option to shun historical analysis simply because causality can't strictly speaking be proven. Historians are well aware of the limitations of their craft. They merely seek to draw the best possible conclusions from the imperfect information that's available to them, as we all do every minute of our lives. No one can escape the constant stream of reports about war, terrorism, and underdevelopment, and in practice, we will always look for an explanation, even if we're not constantly aware of that. Without a solid historical framework, we are bound to find it in prejudice. So it's my firm conviction that it is necessary to seek historical explanations for current events, even if this is a flawed process. Which brings me to the reason why I chose to work anti-chronologically. For what is the quest for causes, if not a retrospective look? If you want to evaluate the current American attitude towards Iran, Saudi Arabia, or Israel, say, you don't start by analyzing the prehistoric past, do you? You first look at how the relationship has become what it is in the short term. If the answers are unsatisfactory, or if they summon up further questions, which they are bound to do, then you dig a little deeper, and so on. However, that's not how history books are structured, is it? To the extent that the authors refer to the present at all, this amounts to little more than a passing comment. Oh, and by the way, this measure is still in force today. That's understandable. History books are usually written by professional researchers, and in their work, the lasting relevance of an event is irrelevant. Rightly so, their first task is to reconstruct exactly what happened, not to speculate about the long-term impact. That offers poor consolation, however, to a reader who is looking for some frame of reference to make sense of a complex world. He'll have to figure that out for himself. But can we reasonably be expected to manage that, if even a professional historian doesn't want to burn his fingers by talking about this? Even children are left to their own devices in this regard. All too often, their heads are stuffed with quiz questions, such as the date of this or that battle, as if we have a lack of important issues that are crying out for context and explanation. The Flemish government has recently decided to create a list of facts and figures that are supposed to define the history of Flanders, and that pupils should memorize, including poems, painters, even a cooking book, I believe. Now, there is nothing wrong with obliging teachers to cover certain topics, but in my humble opinion, each item on that list should at least be able to pass the litmus test of continuing relevance. The best way to check this is to start by looking at the present and then establish what you need to know to understand how we got here. That's also the case in everyday life. If a detective wants to solve a murder case, the first thing he does is track down the last person that the victim was in contact with. If this offered no ready clue, he will dig a little deeper into the past, looking for a possible motif. What he never does, however, is reconstruct the victim's life chronologically. Then he would waste time on matters that would turn out to be totally irrelevant. A detective story usually opens with a corpse, only at the end are the motifs revealed through a flashback. That's comparable to what I try to do in this podcast. In search of explanations for current situations, we methodically descend deeper into the past. Hence the flashbacks. Now, I won't pretend there are no downsides to this approach. There is no ideal way of doing historiography, and this is no exception. For starters, I am aware that this is not always easy to follow. There is a reason, I suppose, why few stories are built up this way. But they exist. Memento by Christopher Nolan. In that film, the viewer gets inside the head of a man who's unable to generate new memories. He can, however, recover older ones. The result is a series of anti-chronological flashbacks, which is why the movie demands a lot of attention from viewers. But if you're the kind of person who likes Christopher Nolan, you won't mind being challenged a bit. I suspect it's the same with people who follow a podcast such as this one, but I might be wrong about that. So I'll put an inquiry in Spotify. If you'd prefer me to adopt a more conventional approach, you can let me know. If an overwhelming number of you ask that, I will seriously consider it. Now, a more fundamental problem with my approach is that by focusing deliberately on things that left a lasting mark, by definition, I ignore all the rest, which creates a distorted picture of how history truly unfolds. It might give a teleological impression, as if all these events in the past automatically lead up to the current situation. I guess you could say that history is the evolution of human culture. Some mutations turn out to be well adapted to their environment, while the others disappear. My approach may obscure this fact because it intentionally ignores unsuccessful mutations. However, I feel like it should suffice to draw attention to this, which I do on a regular basis, including now, of course. The evolutionary biologist John Haldane argued that in his profession, teleology is like a mistress. You can't live without her, but nor do you want to be seen with her in public. Suppose someone says that when bears came to live in snowy places, they evolved so that their furs would become white, which gave them better camouflage and allowed them to survive. This is not how evolution works. It's much more random than that. But some claim that it's impossible to discuss biological concepts without using teleological metaphors. Perhaps professionals could do that in principle when talking among themselves, but when explaining evolution to lay people like myself, I doubt whether there is an alternative. If you have to take into account every random adaptation that failed to bear fruit, evolution or history become totally meaningless. In fact, you couldn't use words like fail or bear fruit. These are teleological concepts too. If you can never explain evolution using such terms, common people, like me, would give up on understanding evolution completely. And before you know it, we are then left with the idea that polar bears are obviously white because their creator wanted them to match the snow. Offering a simplified narrative is far better than none, especially if people are made aware of the simplification. And why would it be different with history, which is essentially the description of cultural evolution? At least in history, there is some intelligent design. Changes aren't totally random. People can consciously adapt, say, a dogma or a law to better fit their circumstances so that the system might survive. Therefore, I think that anti-chronological history does deserve a place among other respectable approaches, neither of which is without drawbacks. Now, whether this always works in this podcast as well as I think it should, that's another matter. I'm still learning on the job here, and I have no examples to turn to see how it's done. It would be interesting to see how a professional historian might handle this, but I fear we are unlikely to find out anytime soon, because this anti-chronological history telling is practically a forbidden art. I sometimes feel like a sorcerer's apprentice performing a silly experiment. It's unlikely to turn lead into gold, and it might well blow up in my face. If that happened to a professional historian, he would be ridiculed by his colleagues, to say nothing of his students. So most, I suspect, will wisely steer clear of such endeavors. That said, if you happen to be a professional historian and you'd like to give me some advice, I'm all ears, of course. On another note, most professional historians are specialists, And this podcast aims to cover thousands of years of history and all of Asia. Now you might ask, if you want to understand how we got here, if that is your purpose, is it really necessary to dig this deep? Does a detective really need to understand the childhood of the victim or of all the likely perpetrators? Well, this is where the analogy shows its limitations, I think, because history is more complex than a murder case. It's true that the recent past has the greatest impact. I think this is reflected in the structure of this podcast. More recent periods get covered more thoroughly. But the distant past also leaves traces behind, in culture, in religion, and in people's collective memory. The relevance thereof usually lies not so much in what really happened, but in the way that the story has taken on a life of its own. Identities are often formed this way. Spoiler alert, Memento's main character tries to reconstruct his own history and identity using sources and clues about his past. But these turn out to have been manipulated, not least, by the protagonist himself. His behavior is guided both by deception and by self-deception. I think this is an apt metaphor for our collective memory. Whoever wants to explain or understand how we got here cannot limit himself to the analysis of one period or one region. If you want to understand, for instance, the current situation in Iraq, but you only watch a documentary about the recent invasion and occupation, I suppose you will get a distorted picture, as if all the current problems are merely the result of a snapshot in time, and perhaps mostly the fault of Americans. If you only saw a biopic about Saddam Hussein, on the other hand, you will draw a very different conclusion, no less short-sighted. I have a fine little book here called The Poisoned Well. It's about the history of the Middle East during the colonial period. The first sentence reads, quote, "The crisis and conflicts of today's Middle East are rooted in the colonial past," end quote. A little further, it says that the modern Middle East is the product of the First World War. Now, although this is not totally untrue, it's far from the whole story, is it? So, if you are looking for perspective, your focus must not be too narrow. And the same is true for the geographical focus. Recent events in Iraq cannot be separated from the situation in, say, Iran or Saudi Arabia. So I'd say that trying to cover the whole history of Asia, it's undoubtedly hubris, but it is a necessary form of hubris. And in a way, it's probably not ambitious enough even, because all history is necessarily world history. And that is more and more true as the world becomes more interconnected. Globalization demands that we broaden our horizons, turn our attention to distant regions. But at the same time, it also calls for specialization, and not just in an economic sense. Historians, too, are reluctant to venture too far beyond their field of specialization, because if they do, they enter the terrain of their colleagues, and thus on thin ice. The amount of knowledge increases exponentially, but not so our individual capacity to process it. And of course, that also applies to me. Given the scope of this podcast, I will inevitably make mistakes or blatant generalizations. In my defense, I think it's an illusion to think that you can escape this by narrowing the subject. No two people are the same, and each of us is constantly changing. Our brain needs some simplification to bring order to the chaos, to see the forest for the trees, or the trees for the atoms. The important thing, again, is to be aware that these are generalizations, I think. For a professional researcher, specialization is probably a must. But if we want a solid historical foundation for our worldview, we cannot afford specialization. Our time is too limited. That is why the scope of this podcast is so broad. I suppose that leaves the question whether I am at all qualified to be doing this. I'm just a fanatical amateur, as Dan Carlin would say, a fan of history. Just like you, I'm trying to get a better understanding of a world that's all in all way too complex for us feeble humans to understand fully. But that said, although I'm not a professional historian, I'm not a complete novice either. I got my master's degree in history with the highest distinction, if I may say so, and a master in international politics too. I didn't pursue a career in academia mostly because I combined my studies with a job that I wasn't prepared to give up. And I also don't like to focus on one narrow subject, as most researchers have to, I think. Now, being an amateur has its upsides too. It means I can do something creative with history without having to worry about an academic reputation, like this podcast. Bottom line, best consider what I'm telling you not as a lecture or something, but as a report on my own ongoing quest for understanding. And if you notice that I'm getting off course somewhere, be so kind as to point me in the right direction. A great advantage of making a podcast instead of a book is that it allows for corrections and to connect with the audience. Speaking of which, feel free to reach out to me. I like nothing better. Thank you for everything. Talk to you real soon. Bye-bye.